I'm Natalie. I'm a social worker at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. I'd like to thank my colleagues who presented before me because I could not have asked for a better introduction. So now I can skip through all my background slides. So I'm just going to talk to you a little bit about our program that we are running now at the Children's Hospital and are kind of in an ongoing evaluation process. So I have no relationships to disclose. Again, my objectives for today are just to tell you a little bit about, and I think it's already, you know, I'm preaching to the choir here, but the relationship between the transition to employment and the transition from pediatric to adult healthcare, and also to learn about the program that we're working on at CHOP. So you heard this background already. There's conflicting numbers. Karen had 30%. I have 12 to 15%. I'm sure we're somewhere in the middle there of adolescents in the U.S. who have special health care needs, and we know that parents and youth both describe this time as being very confusing and kind of can get lost in the process a lot of times, can lead to increased emergency department visits and really just not getting the health care that they need. We also know that youth with chronic illnesses are, so we just actually heard a conflicting study on this one, are less likely than their peers to graduate from high school and to become employed, and more likely to live with their parents after graduation, and more likely to receive public benefits.
There's no comparison to non-disabled kids
in
mind, so there's no conflict.
Okay, yeah, sorry, I wasn't looking properly. So this is how we usually think about, and if you look at the literature, how we usually think about transition for kids with chronic illness and disability. So we really have like the healthcare over here and the employment over here. But what we really see in practice is something that looks a little more like this. So this is kind of a compilation of a couple of kids that I work with. So we really have, you know, a lot of missed school, not learning the skills, the academic skills, the maturity, the organizational skills, not getting a job, not keeping a job, not getting their benefits, not paying for medication, not taking medication, not getting a job. You know, it's all pretty cyclical there. So what can we do to help? So we really need kind of like this really integrated approach. So something that is including, you know, everything you possibly think of, really. So job training, healthcare coordination, benefits counseling, the individualized programming, skill development, and personal development. And that is where our program comes in. So we're really trying to bridge that gap between high school and the world of work for our young adults. So the mission statement is, blah, 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 to evaluate and train students and young adults with disabilities for employment and assist them with transitioning from the pediatric setting to an adult community setting, and that's really in all domains of life. Okay, so our program that I'm going to talk to you about is, we feel that it's a unique model. It's for kids with really the most significant challenges. They often have not had very much social interaction, and even at all, any volunteer or vocational experiences before they come to us. They come to us in their last year of high school or when they're graduating high school. This is because our program is funded through the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation, which many of you may be familiar with. It's, you know, vocational rehab in every state funds kind of assistance for people with disabilities to help with job training and getting jobs. So because of that, they have to come to us when they're done high school because they don't fund that before that. We're working with kids who have special health care needs and or intellectual or developmental disabilities, and they are either not employed or underemployed, so really not doing what they could be doing if they were getting the additional support. What we first start off with is a comprehensive assessment specifically for transition, so it's really a multidisciplinary team, and I'll talk about that in a minute. We have social work and counseling for them throughout the program, and they have a chance to really work within the hospital in a real department, a real setting. They're not like in a group somewhere. They're doing, you know, an internship as if, you know, any of, like I did an internship for social work school. So just kind of a real job, and they're getting that real life experience. So I just kind of talked about this, but we really take all the evaluation, the training, and then the placement component. We help them apply for jobs, look for jobs, resume writing, interview skills, and then our goal is really that competitive employment. So the vocational readiness assessment, which is our evaluation that we do at the beginning before we start our young people in the program, they first we get all, you know, we get different records, school records, as much psychological evaluations as much as is available. Sometimes there's more available than there is for other kids. The assessment is about 3 to 5 days, and it includes an occupational therapy assessment, a physical therapy assessment, a speech therapy assessment, and we have our job coach, who's also a special education teacher by training, and our program manager, who's a vocational counselor by training, and then myself, I'm a social worker. And then we have a meeting with the young adult and their family, whoever they choose to invite, as they are over 18 and have that choice to kind of figure out who is important in their life for them to come to a meeting. And we really talk with them about what, if the program is a good fit, what are their career goals. We don't just want to be placing them in an internship. We want them to be doing something that is meaningful and important to them. So some of our standardized assessments, and those of you who are OTs are probably more, I'm not as familiar with this assessment, but it's the Lowenstein Occupational Therapy Cognitive Assessment, second edition. And so it's looking at functional cognitive skills, and it's normed for teenagers and adults. The Career Occupational Preference System looks at, so there's kind of three measures. So it's looking at, it's having the kids rate like a million different questions on, would you like to do this? I would hate it. I would love it. And it's a kind of like a 5-point Likert scale, and they come out with different domains. They're also looking at work values, and they're also looking at ability. And what the assessment does is it ends up matching up all three of those domains. So you find something that they enjoy that fits with their preferred work environment and that fits with their abilities, which is a really nice thing for them also to be able to see. Some of my things that I do, so we do a brief patient health questionnaire, just kind of as a mental health screener, just not that that's prohibitive of being in a program, of course, but it's nice for us to know is that can be kind of something that influences a young person's ability to work. We're looking at a 14-item resilience scale, so just how they're, I mean, self-report, but how are they rating themselves and kind of their ability to bounce back from difficult situations. And we're looking at the infamous transition readiness assessment questionnaire that you heard lots about from Karen. Our non-standardized assessments, there are a whole bunch, but we're looking really at more functional skills. So things, can they use Word? Can they use Excel? Even if they have never been familiar with Excel before, if it's set up for them, can they, you know, figure out through some, you know, through some problem solving how to put things into what our job coach will do is she'll put, like, you know, label the little columns, and then a lot of kids can be like, okay. And so then we know that with some training they would be, you know, they could be definitely be successful in that area. Other more practical things, you know, setting up a surgical tray, very detail-oriented. A lot of our kids are really awesome at that, finding their way around the hospital. I cannot find my way around the hospital. I would fail that one. But yeah, lots of different things, so I don't know. I always wonder what would happen if I did that on myself. So we're really, so the kind of the five areas that we're looking at are the social emotional functioning, the cognitive functioning, functional life skills. Sorry, I went to my next slide, so I don't look at that slide. The physical ability, so the PT looks at like endurance. She does a standardized endurance test and looking at, can you walk around the hospital all day? Like, would that be a job that would be feasible for you? Or is that just not, you know, is that not something that's a good fit? And the last thing is communication skills. So whether, you know, would a customer service job be a good fit? Maybe there's, you know, maybe that's not what, you know, what you're interested in, that sort of thing. So what the program looks like is we try and do about 2 internships, depending, really it's very individualized. So if the young person is, like, loving their first internship and it's a really great fit with the department, we're not necessarily going to just pull them for the sake of pulling them. But if it's not working, we're going to try another one. If for whatever reason 2 are not working, we're definitely flexible to try a third one if need be. They're getting their professional and personal needs met kind of in a group setting and in an individual setting. And so this lasts for about 6 to 8 months until they start applying for jobs, and they continue with their training and their internship, but they're also building their resume, making, you know, professional contacts and applying for jobs and interviewing. So I think I talked about this, I'll breeze through, but really a lot of skill development, for any of the different types of jobs I've mentioned, so things that you would need to learn, how to be appropriate on email, you know, things that our young adults may have just never come across. So that's, you know, simple things. Check your email every day. A lot of times they never respond to my emails. And then individual sessions on work ethic, how to communicate appropriately with your supervisors, when do you call in sick, how do you call in sick. We have internships all throughout the hospital, so in linens and material distribution, they are one of the most confusing departments I've ever seen. They have this like very fancy electronic system. Every single thing that comes into the hospital is logged in. Every single thing that's brought up to a floor is logged out. So our guys have to learn this whole like electrical logging in system. We have, you know, reception and human resources. They always tell me about all the crazy calls they get, about people who like really want to know about their job application. So we really have our guys all throughout the hospital. We'll skip this one. So after they, what is my time? After they have gotten a job, then they continue their job coaching for 90 days, and that's the funder pays for the 90 days, so for their kind of probation period, and we help them kind of make sure, get their benefits set up, make sure they're learning any new any new tasks that they have that are expected of them in a new job. We have in hospitals, I'm sure many other companies have, we kind of have mandatory learning or mandatory education. It's all done online, so if they need help navigating that system, then we help them with that. And we continue to fade out throughout the 90 days. So our success so far. So we've been around since 2007. We have had 31 young adults who have gained competitive employment, so which we're saying is greater than $10 an hour, where most of our guys start at about $12 to $15. So we're really looking for not just, you know, minimum wage job, but we want something that they're really going to be proud of and also able to get, you know, a relatively significant amount of income. We have 12 young adults who've been employed for greater than 2 years now. Or 31, so my caveat is our 31, you know, a couple of them were hired like a couple weeks ago, or like a month ago, so obviously they haven't been employed for 2 years. And then we have 10 young adults who are receiving their employer benefits instead of their public benefits. Our success. So in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, which are the states in our area, the number of vocational rehabilitation cases that are closed and end in employment, so we have 31.8% in New Jersey, 37.7% in Pennsylvania. We have a 56.4% rate. No one's doing like an amazing job, but we're doing a little better. This isn't the cleanest data because we're obviously not representative of the state, but that's just to give you an idea. Am I done? I'm almost done. Okay. So basically, I hope that I've given you the message that we really have employment and healthcare linked. I don't know a way to separate them. And this is just a quote from our director of materials distribution. So they have hired many people, but at the beginning they hired, you know, two wonderful employees. I think they hired our first two kids who were hired. So we didn't have to sacrifice, we didn't have to pay overtime. We were able to hire two employees who are more than happy and willing to do the work. They have saved the department thousands in overtime fees and help our daily battle to maintain an efficient environment. They are treasures. They make us take pause and push ourselves a little harder. So that's a little picture. And that's my contact information, and I guess we can take questions.
This is exciting. Very exciting program. Questions?
So here's one out of the 200 items that I thought of while I was listening. Is the problem with this was a clear read from the talk. Is the problem with getting kids, adult providers, that the healthcare system is very dysfunctional, they're not available in their geographic area, taking their insurance? That's a problem that, no, they're really out there if they just know how to navigate the system.
Yeah, I think I have to go up to the microphone.
I think that it's actually a combination of both things, and Natalie was also part of the study, so she can speak to this if she feels necessary, but I think that, so one of the problems that we have at our hospital is a lot of our patients have Medicaid, and one of the biggest Medicaid providers that we take at CHOP, they don't take across the street at the adult hospital that we like to refer people to, which doesn't make any sense to us, but it makes it a little bit more tricky. And there are also some providers that aren't an appropriate fit for some of our patients, and so I think that sometimes there's a lack of providers in a specific area or a lack of providers that we've identified in a specific area and have connections with and trust. But also there's this other insurance piece that was really highlighted in the findings.
I had a second follow-up. Do you think this will change in the ACO environment?
I think it's too soon to tell. I hope so. And I think we and our colleagues have been working specifically with a lot of insurance companies within the area to try and create better relationships and see how we can get insurance taken across the different systems that are directly across the street from each other. So I guess time will tell.
If I can also add my 2 cents, because one of my kids has a pediatric cardiac issue, and she lives in New York City. Insurance wasn't really an issue, but she had a very tough time trying to find the intervention. She did some kind of nonprofit of survivors of pediatric cardiology problems, but it's just very hard to find adult treatment.
Yeah, and so sometimes what we see at our hospital is a lot of those patients end up staying in the pediatric setting. So we have like 35 and 40-year-olds who are still seeing the pediatric cardiologist, and that creates a whole other host of issues that we are also trying to work on.
She went on strike. She said she wasn't going to.
Exactly. Then you have that problem.
What's going on in these conversations that kids are having with their families at home? Are the parents just yelling at their kids about what's going on in school? Or, I mean, why doesn't talking to your kids? It surprised me that talking to your kids about school didn't lead to a more positive outcome. And for example, and you know, it may just be that the more need the child has, the more parents talk to them. But I talk to my kid all the time about schools, and he's a pretty he does quite well in school. So I would like to understand that better, and also understand the relationship between what's going on with parent teacher conferences and the IEP meetings that would explain the results that I got. In addition to perhaps just kids need more support.
Sure.
Yeah, I think in this particular study I talked about, we took all those factors into consideration, but because the youth were above 19 and identified by the primary care provider as being seen in the past year and ready to transition, we didn't look at those factors as much as we do in some other areas of work that we look at. But for these REACH sessions, our psychoeducational programs, we did not just implement them specifically for this study. We have them throughout the year in different areas. So one of the ones we run pretty often is called REACH for College. So it's for youth with chronic illnesses and disabilities of various types who are planning to attend college. So in that, we have specific sections on healthcare, how to talk to your roommate about your condition, how to find a doctor in some other place if that's what you're going to be doing, and then talking about what you need to think about when you're looking at dorms at a college. So we try and really push self-advocacy and self-management so that the youth have the ability to do these things on their own, and that's, I think, the highest thing that we look for.
My name is Kiyoshi Shiramaki from the University of Illinois at Chicago. I have a question for the healthcare transition things. Illinois is in the process of moving Medicaid from fee-for-service to managed care, with the hope that managed care can provide better care coordination, service coordination, so that, you know, putting together and fracturing the service into the same place. In your case, the Medicaid patients are still fee-for-service, or if you guys are doing managed care for the Medicaid adult population, and is there any experience that you can tell the other states that, you know, it's working very well, or it's still problematic for whatever?
I'm an insurance expert, but as far as we're not there yet. We're not at that managed care level. So, I mean, we do have, it's really more for the pediatric population. They have managed care for kids with special health care needs, kind of like service coordinators or what have you for that population. They do help somewhat, but it really ends at 21, that piece of it. I hope that, and like Karen said, there are definitely some talks with, I think the insurance companies want to learn how to do that better, and we would love that. But we're just not there yet, so hopefully we'll get there.
And then one more question.
So I want to know a little bit about how you've involved young people in your program as developers and deliverers of content, and whether you found that to be helpful or not, and what kinds of things are helpful. And as you think, too, about your response rate and the difficulty of recruiting, whether you can talk a little bit about how they were involved or not.
So, again, for this specific study, youth were not very involved in the process of developing it. In other things that we do, specifically in these REACH events, our hospital has a youth advisory council. So patients who go to the hospital often or want to be involved in their healthcare sit on this board. And when different departments or divisions want to get something done and want the experience of youth to be a part of that, we go to the youth advisory council meeting and we ask them what they think. So recently we went back to them and said, okay, guys, we run this program called the REACH program. This is what we do. Would you like it? Would it be helpful to you? How could we improve it? And a lot of the feedback we got was, well, the brochures and like all the stuff, it all just looks like hospital stuff. It all looks the same, so we don't want to read it, and we don't want to partake in it because we don't really think it's for us. A lot of them said that we should engage participants using more technology, so putting QR codes on posters so they could like go online automatically, having virtual sessions so that they could sign on from their couch, things like that that was most of what we got. So we try and incorporate their information, and then when we do all of these sessions, we do evaluations, so we try and take that into consideration as well.
Yeah. And just to add two more points. the REACH sessions that Karen's been speaking about actually did start with a group of focus groups. And what the kids were saying is, we want to hear from mentors. We want to hear from people who are like us. So we actually, at all of our REACH programs, we include people who are older, who have disabilities and chronic illnesses, and they're really able to share their experiences. And I mean, we learn a lot from them, and that's, you know, wonderful.
So I just want to put in a plug for a little deeper engagement of young people. I found that when I've done that at the beginning of the project, they fundamentally change my view of the world. And they wouldn't come back to, you should have done it differently. So they really are smart. They know what they're doing.